Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. Today's conversation is another deep dive into protein to complement a recent episode 191 that we had with Vasanta Molina, where we focused on the amount of protein we should get. And we're going to dig a little deeper today into quality of protein and its environmental impact. And I am fortunate to be joined by one of the people I have the greatest respect for, Brenda Davis, and her wonderful son, Corey Davis. Brenda is one of the world's leading plant-based pioneers and an internationally acclaimed speaker. Widely regarded as a rock star of plant-based nutrition, she's been referred to by Veg News as the, quote, godmother of vegan dietitians and was the 2022 recipient of the Plantrition Project's Luminary Award. Brenda's work focuses on ensuring that everyone who wishes to be plant-based can succeed brilliantly. She lives in Alberta, Canada, with her husband, Paul, and you can visit her at brendadavisrd.com. Corey is a professional agrologist who has worked in natural resource management since 2012 and has been a lifelong advocate for animal welfare and environmental stewardship. His broad range of experience and diverse degrees encompassing business, the sciences, and intercultural relations have given him a unique integrated perspective on sustainable practices and their effects on human health and well-being. Corey lives in British Columbia, Canada. Brenda, Corey, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So excited to talk more about a topic that I think comes up a lot, which is around protein. Brenda, I've always loved our conversations, and it's so nice to have you back on the podcast. You have written, how many books have you written now?
13.
13, okay. Amazing. So congratulations, and congratulations on your most recent book on plant-powered protein. What led to the most recent book?
Well, I would say what led to it was actually our publisher, or one of our main publishers, just said, we get this question all the time. Well, it seems good. It seems good for the environment, for the animals and all that, but how the heck are we supposed to get our protein? And so I think that he just said, we need a book that really puts to rest all of the myths surrounding protein and plant-based diets. And we wanted the book to be comprehensive. We just decided it would be worth doing. And it was so fun, Vasanta and I, thinking about what we wanted included. And we thought about, you know, the environmental aspect or the environmental consequences of our protein choices, and thought how wonderful it would be to bring in an environmental expert. And Corey just filled the bill perfectly. So that was really special for me to have him as part of this book as well.
Absolutely. You know, we were talking earlier of how wonderful for, you know, you to be able to work together, and just what a joy it is to be able to do that. So how wonderful that you knew an expert quite well.
Yes.
Can speak to that. That's wonderful. And Corey, what got you interested in the environmental aspects of protein?
I've always been interested in the environmental impacts of what we eat from a young age. I mean, when I was 15 years old, we went on the Compassion for Animals Road Expedition, and I took it upon myself to start giving environmentally friendly food demonstrations, so cooking demos at all kinds of venues across the United States. And it was there I started to really think about it in depth. That started to grow throughout my academic career. Of course, I started in the social sciences, which gave me a really good insight into social issues. But of course, what I realized at that point is that environmental issues and social issues are so closely related and intertwined, which really motivated me to take a deeper dive into the environment. And it just so happened that my career led me to agrology, which is about food sciences. And I mostly work in the environmental conservation side of agrology, less so the soil science side. So it was a natural progression for me to get here. And at this point in my career, it just so happened they were looking for somebody to do a piece on the environment, something that I had been thinking about deeply for the past 20 years with personal experience in.
Yeah, so how wonderful that you could bring this all in together. And I think that certainly makes this book very special. Just having recently read a good portion of it, it's very unique in what it offers. And I never read a lot of books about plant-based nutrition. So Brenda, when you think about protein quality in protein is, I think, defined very differently by different people. But what's a framework to think about just the quality and the protein that you're getting?
Yeah, well, traditionally, protein quality has been based on the ability of a protein to provide the essential amino acids that humans need and the digestibility of that protein, period. So we had protein efficiency ratio and the protein digestibility corrected amino acid score, you know, all of these different measures of protein quality, but based solely on those two things. And they're important, there's no question. But the traditional definition of protein quality ignores some really important factors in terms of how our protein sources impact our health risk. And so it completely ignores the consequences of our protein choices in terms of our risk of chronic disease, for example. It ignores the environmental consequences of those protein choices. And to me, any really good definition of protein quality needs to somehow integrate those things as well. Because it's all well and good that a protein is providing all of the essential amino acids and is highly digestible. But if that protein source causes colorectal cancer or increases your risk of heart disease or diabetes, to me, that impacts its quality in a pretty big way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because when people ask questions around nutrition, is this good? Is it bad? What outcome measure you're looking for, you know, can affect the answer to that. With protein, I think there's a lot of focus on muscle mass and avoiding sarcopenia, which is loss of muscle mass with aging. Do you think that in this conversation around protein and getting the appropriate amino acids, would your answer be different for muscle mass and sarcopenia versus chronic disease prevention and longevity?
Yes, actually, it would in some respects. So for example, seniors, one of the things that happens as you get older is your ability to digest and absorb nutrients is diminished. And protein is a perfect example of that. So you are not able to get what a younger person is able to get eating the exact same food. And so many experts now believe that the RDA for protein for adults is 0.8 grams per kilogram body weight, that it should actually be reassessed for seniors, if you will. And there are actually countries in Europe and Australia, for example, that have separate recommendations for seniors of, you know, about 25% higher than younger adults. And this is such a challenge because seniors tend to eat less food and fewer calories. And so they actually need to be eating a more nutrient-dense diet. They need to be getting more protein, more vitamins and minerals for a smaller number of calories. That's really hard. A lot of seniors, they don't have the energy, they don't have the ability to chew, they're socially isolated, they may be on a very tight budget. There are just so many reasons that it makes it harder for a senior. We need to rethink, and especially in terms of plant-based diets, rethink things a little bit for seniors. And one of the things that I think is important for seniors is that they do focus a little bit more on the protein-rich plant foods as they age. And so you want the diet to be a little more heavily weighted towards the legume family. So the beans and lentils and tofu and tempeh and those kinds of foods, chickpeas and edamame and all of those things should feature more prominently in the diet than they might have when you were younger. And so it's teaching cooking pea soups and bean soups and lentil soups and so on, making patties out of these things. But again, that takes some skills in the kitchen. We really are in a different situation with seniors, for sure. And preventing sarcopenia, most of the experts are saying we should be striving for 1 to 1.3 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. And that really is not that easy to achieve for a senior.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a really good point about total caloric intake. So as people get older, I know for a lot of my patients, their appetite's just diminished as they're getting older. So their caloric intake is naturally less. And you generally don't want people to kind of force themselves to eat when they're not hungry. But getting protein, as you're mentioning, is certainly you have to be a lot more intentional. If a person just gets meals with lentils, but their caloric intake has, say, dropped by 25% when they were younger, without calculating their actual grams of protein intake, would they, as a general rule, be getting enough, or do they really need to be more deliberate and intentional to make sure they're getting their adequate needs?
In my experience, I think they need to be more deliberate and intentional. I've actually worked with several people in the last couple of years who have started to notice thin skin, easy bruising, hair falling out, a lot of the symptoms of a mild protein deficiency. I mean, it's not kwashiorkor, but it's still, we do see this. And I have one lady who is probably about 84 years old now, who just wrote to me yesterday and said, "I can't believe how much better my skin is. I don't bruise anymore. My hair is fuller." And she said, all I did was boost my protein intake. And of course, when you boost your protein intake, you also boost your iron, your zinc, a lot of those trace minerals, because legumes are key sources of those things. But it's as simple as if you think of a senior consuming, say for breakfast, some sort of flaked cereal with almond milk and a sliced banana. Well, that meal might provide 5 grams of protein. They need to be aiming for at least 20 to 25 grams of protein per meal. And some experts would even say 30 for larger people. So how do they accomplish that, eating a bowl of cereal? Well, I cook whole grains and I cook lentils in with my grains. I use soy milk instead of almond milk, because it has 8 grams of protein per cup and almond milk has 1. And then on top of the cereal, I'll add hemp seeds and maybe some almonds, some homemade seedy granola. Those kinds of foods can easily add up to 20 grams of protein in the end. And that is what a typical breakfast that I would have would provide. So there are ways of not necessarily changing completely the way that you're eating, but thinking more about what are your protein sources at that meal? So for lunch, if you're used to having a big salad, are you adding little cubes of tofu? Are you adding some beans? I add 2 or 3 protein sources to my salad, sprouted lentils, little tofu cubes, sometimes a little marinated bean salad. So those are ways that you can really boost the protein content of your meal. And I do think seniors need to be a little bit more intentional about thinking, do I have a decent source of protein at this meal?
That's really helpful, Brenda. And seniors, the term, I just want to maybe define that a little bit. I think sometimes people think seniors are maybe way down the road. One day I'll have to think about this, because a lot of people think old is 10 years plus your current age, right?
That's true.
And certainly there are a lot of people that are middle age or even late middle age, and the digestibility, I mean, I imagine like most human functions, there's a continuum where it's over time, your ability to absorb, digest nutrients, it's more of a continuum of how it's declining, as opposed to now you've hit 65 and your body's not working at this age. Is there a role for people in middle age, late middle age, to start to be transitioning into an increased intake? And I say that more for personal.
Exactly. So I'll tell you, I'm just a few months away from being 65. That age is, 65, 70 is sort of, I think in Australia, they're older adults. They count people 70 plus. In some countries, it's 65 plus. But you're so right. There is a continuum and we're all unique. I think of myself as still not being much different than I was when I was 30 because I'm physically able to still do what I could do when I was 30. But I know that my body is changing. And I have to tell you, I do focus a little bit more on making sure I've got some protein at each meal because I really want to maintain my muscle mass. It's so important for ensuring that you're stronger, that you don't, that your balance is better, you don't fall as easily, all of those things. And I know as we age, that matters more in your 80s and 90s than in your mid-60s or 70s, depending on the person. But it's still, we want to start transitioning a little bit earlier so it just becomes part of what we do.
Yeah, and it makes it really relevant to a very large percentage of the population. So thinking about it as we go along as opposed to one day when we are X age. So thank you for that.
Yes, exactly.
And Corey, so a lot of people are focused a lot, of course, on getting the nutrients they need. There's an extra level of thinking about the source of the nutrients that they're getting and the practices behind how food has arrived at their grocery store. When it comes to protein, what are environmental considerations of how, like, where does our protein come from an environmental standpoint and agricultural standpoint?
I really appreciate that. I usually categorize the environmental impacts that I'm interested in most into about four: land use and biodiversity loss, climate change, water pollution, and water use. Of course, there's transport. We can link that into climate change. But it's important to note that when we categorize things in such a way, we are separating them and they're not separated. Climate change and land use, water security, they're all very interrelated, which makes it very difficult to do, but it's useful to do that as we categorize, and then we could make measurements and show the differences. So we could show, for example, vast differences in greenhouse gas emissions from different food alternatives. What are we going to focus our diets on? Resource-intensive products or less resource-intensive products?
And can you give us a little bit more of what are, you know, if we get, for example, tofu versus if we got eggs versus if we had a steak, what the impact is of each of those?
Yeah, well, if we just want to talk emissions, for example, beef is the largest in the animal category with about almost 50 kilograms of carbon emissions per 100 grams of protein. Eggs would have the lowest at about 4.2 kilograms of carbon emissions per 100 grams of protein. Tofu, which I use as an alternative to both eggs and beef, I love a good tofu steak and some good old scrambled tofu, is less than 2 kilograms. That's two times less than eggs and more than 25 times lower than beef. So the amount of reductions, the relative reduction you get from making those alternatives is massive, and it's very difficult to find those kind of reductions elsewhere in our lives.
What's the cumulative impact? I understand the relative difference between them, but when we look at what level becomes significant on impacting the environment, how does that look at in terms of the bigger picture?
I really, really appreciate that. Again, it's really difficult to parse things down into categories. I love looking at it at more of a systems level. If we just zoom out for a moment, 50% of all habitable land, and I'm sure many of your listeners have heard this before, is used for agriculture. About 80% of that land is used for animal agriculture. There is more land being used for animal agriculture than there are forests in the world. And we're deforesting our forest reserves at a staggering rate, 5 million hectares every year. And of course, with that comes biodiversity losses. But also, we've got to take a look at what is the impact of turning these carbon sink ecosystems, ecosystems that sequesters carbon from the atmosphere, into carbon sources, ecosystems that emit carbon into the atmosphere. And how would that relate to water security? Well, tree cover is inextricably linked to our water cycle through evapotranspiration. That's where trees absorb water through their roots and then release it as water vapor into the air, increasing atmospheric moisture availability, and its cross-continental transport. And this is extremely impactful for regional water cycles in our continental interiors, especially in the summertime, which is really important because today it feels like I live in British Columbia, where wildfires are raging and we're facing a lot of drought. So much drought that cattle farmers are struggling to even feed their cattle hay. And in drought conditions, our small water bodies become even smaller, and the water pollution, therefore, becomes more concentrated. And so you could see the link, the string throughout all these things: biodiversity loss, climate change, water scarcity, and water pollution. They're all linked in such a way.
And Corey, this is a question that there may not be an answer to, but if, let's say, every person globally switched one meal a day from having some animal product to being entirely plant-based, is there any metric that would look at the environmental impact of that?
Sure. I don't know the specific impact that would have, but it would be massive. As I mentioned before, tofu uses about 10 times less water than beef. In terms of water use, we often pick on industries like fracking. They use 70 to 140 billion gallons of water a year, a massive amount. Agriculture uses 2 quadrillion gallons of water per year. If you can make a reduction of 10 times in one meal, especially when you're thinking about water-intensive products such as beef, I mean, it's massive. A study came out just a couple years ago now, 2021, and it looked at the opportunity cost of land use change. And what it found was that if we were to go plant-based by 2050, we would and rewild all of that deforested land that we now use for pasture and animal feeding operations, we would sequester 16 years worth of greenhouse gas emissions and grant humanity a 66% chance of meeting the Paris Accord agreement of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That move alone. Of course, in terms of water pollution, not only is agriculture perhaps the biggest culprit, nitrates being the most common water pollutant around the world, but animal manure, livestock manure, contains 150 different pathogens, 6 of which are responsible for 90% of foodborne and waterborne illnesses. That's Cryptosporidium, Listeria, Giardia, E. coli, Salmonella, probably missing one. But if we could reduce that, those emissions into our water bodies, that would be another massive impact. We could reduce algal blooms. I mean, manure spills are rarely talked about when we think about water pollution, but one spill can have quite a devastating impact on aquatic ecosystems. One, I think it was a hog farm spill, manure spill, I believe it was in Minnesota, Minnesota absorbs over a dozen manure spills every year. And forgive me if I'm misplacing this particular spill. It was in 2012. Prior to the spill, biologists sampled 9 different fish species after this spill, which I believe it was estimated to have killed tens of thousands of fish, about 18,000 different mussels, 2 years after this spill, biologists returned and couldn't find one of the fish species they sampled before. The impacts of a spill is just absolutely devastating, or can be absolutely devastating.
And, you know, which kind of brings us to a question for you, Brenda, the health impact. So if people are preferentially leaning into more plant-based sources of protein, chronic disease impact, longevity impact, what are some considerations for people who may want to switch one meal or more and shift towards plant-based?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting when you look at the number of studies that have been done. Generally, it is very consistent. When you swap animal protein for plant protein, everything gets better. Your risk of heart disease, your risk of cancer, your risk of type 2 diabetes, you know, your risk of mortality, all-cause mortality, it all plummets. And in fact, there are three studies that I can think of off the top of my head, one from 2016, one from 2019, and one from 2020, that actually looked at what would happen if you replace 3%, just 3% of calories from animal protein with plant protein. And just to put this into perspective, 3% of calories is 60 calories in a 2,000-calorie diet. So it's about 1 ounce of meat, less than one large egg. So one large egg would be closer to 80 calories, about 78 calories, I think. And so this is a very small amount of animal protein. Swapping that out for plant protein will give you, according to the 2020 study, about a 10% drop in overall mortality. And, you know, if you look specifically at meat, eggs, dairy, and you actually do the math for how much each of these would reduce mortality, if you replaced a large egg, 2 ounces of meat, and a cup of milk, you would actually reduce mortality by about 54%. It's really quite stunning. And then if you look at the research and look at specific diseases like cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, cancer, you see the same kinds of data. I know there was a study in 2020 that reported heart failure was 2.5 times or 251% greater in the highest versus the lowest quintile of animal protein intake. And it was 56% lower in the highest versus lowest intake of legumes. And then there was a study from Finland, and this one was shocking. They just looked at replacing 1% of calories from animal protein with plant protein, and that's 20 calories. It's nothing. And risk of type 2 diabetes dropped 18%. And then there was a study in 2019 from Japan that found replacing 3%, so this is like 60 calories, of meat with plant protein, cancer mortality would drop 39% if what you were replacing is red meat, and 50% if what you were replacing was processed meat. So it's very, very consistent evidence. And it's not rocket science. If you think about this, plant-based protein foods, they're foods like lentils and chickpeas and tofu and so on, but they're rich sources generally of fiber, phytochemicals, antioxidants, plant sterols and stanols, sometimes pre and probiotics. You know, all of these things that we know to be associated with reduced risk of disease. On the other hand, animal protein sources are sources of saturated fat, cholesterol, heme iron, a new 5-GC, which is a really pro-inflammatory molecule, heterocyclic amines if they're cooked at high temperatures, and even advanced plantation end products, TMAO and its precursors, endotoxins, chemical contaminants that move up the food chain. These are things that are associated with increased risk of disease. So it really makes a lot of sense that you're going to see quite a significant advantage in terms of disease risk reduction if you switch over to plant-based proteins.
I was going to ask you the why behind the numbers as you were talking about the shift of 3% your calories. And as you're kind of framing it, it's less of the bad stuff, more of the good stuff. So even though it's 60 calories, you're taking away 60 bad calories and adding in 60 good calories. So there's a bigger effect than just that 60 calories. And what you're talking about is also, if we took it a level deeper to more, I guess, a hormonal molecular level, the effect of things like IGF-1, for example, on mTOR pathway, on pathways that affect cell growth, I think everyone's always wondering, why are we seeing such a stark difference between the plant sources versus the animal sources? Are there any leading ideas behind that? Or, I know people talk about branched chain amino acids contributing to some of those pathways for growth, but is there any recent information in terms of mechanistically of what's accounting for it besides all the things you already mentioned?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of times when you think of it, there are some really significant drivers of chronic disease, like inflammation, oxidative stress, dysbiosis, lipotoxicity. These drivers, they're increased when we eat the animal products compared to the plant products. And you mentioned, the branched chain amino acids, the mTOR pathway, the IGF-1 levels, all of those things come into play. But essentially, when you eat a diet that promotes dysbiosis or an unhealthy gut microbiome, it impacts every single body system. It impacts the brain, it impacts the immune system, it impacts, our production of cytokines or pro-inflammatory mediators. It just, all of that. And it's the same with inflammation. There's not a chronic disease that we know of that isn't pushed forward with inflammation and oxidative stress and, even lipotoxicity. When we think about what happens when we overconsume calories, which is really common on an omnivorous diet, especially one that is rich in animal products and processed foods, we end up having more calories than what we can deal with, and they're often stored in places that excess fat shouldn't be stored, like in our vital organs and too much in our cells and in our muscle cells and so forth. And so I think all of those things come together to be increasing risk.
And where do supplements fit in this picture in terms of impact on health?
Well, are you talking specifically about protein supplements or just?
Yes, protein supplements and their equivalent to getting them from natural food sources.
Yeah. And in my view, generally, most people don't need protein supplements. I think the only people that would even want to consider protein supplements are high-level competitive athletes who are striving to get 1.6 to 2 grams of protein per kilogram body weight, or athletes who are in a phase of trying to cut, so they're really getting lean for a bodybuilding competition or something, and so they're cutting back calories, but they don't want to. They're at that stage probably aiming for 1.8 to 2.4 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. And so when they're trying to really cut calories, it can be hard to meet their protein requirements so they don't lose muscle mass. And in those circumstances, having a smoothie with the extra protein may make sense. For some seniors who have a really difficult time meeting their needs for leucine and just protein in general, there may be situations where it could make sense, especially if they have swallowing difficulties and so forth, to have smoothie with a little bit of added protein. I generally go for, rather than the concentrated proteins, using things like hemp seeds and whole foods in the smoothies, but there are some pretty decent vegan protein powders that are clean and sourced from whole foods and are decent products. So it definitely is an option. But it, for me, for a lot of people, it's more of a convenience that they're using them than anything else. And for the vast majority of us, to be quite honest with you, I've never used a protein powder in my life. I think they taste horrible. They have this weird taste and I don't like it. I tasted, at these exhibits, tasting a little bit, and I've never found one that I like the taste of. And I don't think I need it because I do include plenty of protein in my diet. So most of us who are just, you know, I'm a very active individual, but I'm not a competitive athlete. I don't need that big boost that you would be getting from protein powders.
And how about the plant-based meat substitutes? How do they fit into this bigger conversation?
Well, you know, I love that you asked this question because it's so controversial. And, you know, in the whole food plant-based world, you know, it has to be beans or lentils, and people very much look down upon the meat substitutes and so on. But I have a little different perspective on this. And my perspective is different because I really don't want people to be eating animals. I wish we could shut down slaughterhouses and shut down factory farms. To me, anything that we're producing that would replace meat that is more compassionate, more ecologically sustainable, and still tastes good, I think there's a place for that. And I have to say, if you're familiar with Christopher Gardner's work, he did a study, I think it was with 36 individuals, where they ate the same diet throughout the study, but they spent a certain chunk of time eating the plant-based meats versus the regular meats. And so many people have said, you know, these new veggie meats that are super like real meat, they're super highly processed. They'll be way worse for you than meat. And they are high in saturated fat, you know, all of that. But in his study, he found almost all of the markers he looked at improved with when people ate the veggie meat. So they had lower cholesterol. You know, everything was lower. They lost more weight, on average a pound or two. You know, it wasn't a lot, but it still was significant because it was consistent. And so there were a number of advantages to switching to the veggie meats. Now, that having been said, you know, there's a huge range of healthfulness of these products. Some are made from beans and quinoa, and some are made from very concentrated proteins. And so there's a big difference in the amount of preservatives or whatever added and how the protein's extracted. And there are a lot of factors that come into play. But generally, my feeling is for most people eating plant-based diets that these products, or eating omnivorous diets for that matter, these products can be handy. It's nice to send your child, you know, to scout camp with a hot dog when all the kids are roasting hot dogs, or a burger when they're having burgers. They can be fine. Nutritionally, the protein quality in these products is super high generally because they're more concentrated, often soy or something like that. And so very good amino acids and super digestible because there's not that much fiber compared to eating legumes. So for someone like a senior man or woman who isn't cooking very much and who wants to grab something from the freezer, I mean, certainly they want to compare sodium levels, but it could be a super convenient way for them to add a little bit of protein. And so I think it can make sense at a lot of levels. So for myself, I do include some of these foods, but very occasionally. And sometimes if company's coming or something like that, and you want to make something that, especially for omnivorous company, that they might enjoy. But generally, I make my own. I just made, I think, 30 burgers out of grated beets and lentils and walnuts, and that's my usual. But I wouldn't say, no, I'll never eat them. And I think it's wonderful that we can get a veggie burger when everybody's getting a burger at a restaurant, for example.
Yeah, no, that's a really great perspective. I appreciate that. And Corey, if there's one thing you wish people knew about the agricultural and environmental impact of how protein is sourced, or the thing that you think people would be most surprised about, what would you say that would be?
I would say that it is the social justice component, the social impacts that our diet has on the environment and the world. And of course, when we think of the cumulative impact, we have to look at the historical context. I think a lot of people would be shocked to understand the history of animal exploitation in North America and how we've terraformed this beautiful place to suit old world or European taste preferences as a whole. So we took this landscape and literally transformed it to suit our own tastes. And the social impacts of that is not just oppressive in nature to minority groups, such as indigenous communities, but the health consequences of such. And we often think about the environment as being separate. When we're really connected, we are part of the environment. And those environmental impacts comes back to us, even mentally, our sense of place, for one. The air we breathe, which is smoky in BC. And a lot of different environmental impacts have contributed to this. But I think that we put agriculture aside because agriculture is something we need. We need food. And so those impacts are justified. But again, there's agriculture that's very resource intensive, that produces products that use a lot more water, emit a lot more greenhouse gas emissions, pollute more, use a lot of land. And then there's alternatives that don't. And so those impacts are not necessary. And I think bringing that together and bringing the social side of environmental impacts and the food we eat, the history of North America, and indeed the rest of the world, I think would shed a lot of light and perhaps might be more accepted to people who might then be able to relate to those impacts.
And Brenda, if you were to talk to your clients or just talk to patients in general about protein, what do you think is something that is often maybe not accurately presented, or maybe some misleading information that you feel is really important for people to know about?
I would say that a lot of people are under the misconception that plants don't really provide protein. And they just assume that we need animal products for protein because plant foods aren't really good sources. And nothing could be further from the truth. So human beings need about 10 to 15% of calories from protein. And almost all whole plant foods exceed that, so, or are in that ballpark. So the average vegan or person eating 100% plant-based would get probably 12 to 14% of calories from protein. Now, if you look at various foods, legumes are generally 20 to 40% of calories from protein. Non-starchy vegetables are in the same ballpark. There are a few that are lower, but they are generally around 20 to 40. Nuts, grains, seeds are generally in the neighborhood of 10 to 20. And the only foods that really fall below that range are fruits and some starchy vegetables. Certain potatoes and such might be slightly under 10%. But if you eat a variety of whole plant foods and you get enough calories, your intake of protein is usually very, very good. A lot of people don't realize that protein isn't something that you necessarily want to get too much of. So it's not a race to see who can get the most protein. Getting a lot of protein doesn't mean you're going to have, you know, bigger muscles. It gets converted and stored if it's excess calories. And so we want to get, you know, if you look at people in the blue zones, for example, the places where people live the longest, healthiest lives, they average 10 to 15% of calories from protein, and so do plant-based eaters. So it's really not something we need to be as concerned about as many people think. And in fact, there was a study that I think is super interesting. It's not a new study. It was from 2014 by Levine, and they looked at, you know, the percent of calories from protein. And what they found is people who were 50 to 65 years of age who consumed 20% of calories from protein or more had about a 75% increased risk of mortality and about a 4 times increased risk of cancer and diabetes. And what was really interesting is that relationship was basically non-existent if the protein was coming from plants. It was only if the protein was animal-derived that we saw the increased risk in mortality and chronic disease. Now, what was also interesting about that study is they did not find that relationship for people 66 years of age and older. And in fact, people who were 66 plus who had less than 10% of calories from protein had a higher risk of mortality and chronic disease. And I think it's because what we talked about, that they're actually not digesting and absorbing the amino acids the way younger people do. And so they need a little bit more protein. The researchers suggested that they need at least 10% of calories from protein to prevent sarcopenia and fragility and all of the, you know, associated problems, osteoporosis and so forth.
Yeah. Well, Brenda and Corey, I always enjoy our conversations because of the just the depth and the richness of what you add to the conversation in any topic we've ever talked about. So thank you so much for joining today. And Corey, it's just been so nice to have you kind of complement what your mom has added on the larger conversation to plant-based nutrition. So thank you guys both so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure.
Well, likewise. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.